My guest this week is an acclaimed winemaker who didn't always used to be a winemaker. He comes from a very different working world, but in between surfing, has now produced some of South Africa's finest wine. Craig Wessels, Restless River, a very warm welcome.
Dan, thank you very much. Good morning.
I hope you understand, first up, the esteem and regard in which you are held, because you arrived in studio nice and early this morning, wielding a bottle of your new, very highly regarded Pinot Noir. And I charged out and went round the corner to the Pep Home store, because we only deal in the very best on Dan Really Likes Wine.
I understand.
And shelled out almost $100 on a quartet of the very finest glasses. I think that Pep Home Store don't pay to be on the show, but I have it on good authority that they are the only supplier of stemware to David Higgs for the Marble Group. And this is, so that's about a $12.70 glass.
It's a work of art.
For about a $7,000 bottle of wine.
The nice thing about these glasses, you can drop them and they bounce.
Although from a height, you could probably kill somebody with them. But what wonderful wine inside, and wonderful wine that is celebrating 20 years this year.
20 years. I can't believe it. Yeah, we started in 2004 and 2024, 20 years later, things are going well. So it's been a great journey.
I think it's a cracking understatement. Things are going well. I've seen the fights when your allocations go out as people try and get hold of a wine that two decades ago just did not exist, because at that stage, it certainly wasn't Craig Wessels' highly regarded and celebrated winemaker.
No.
You're in a very different industry.
I don't think it's there yet either, but...
give it time.
Yeah, we'll get there one day, maybe third generation.
So go back, let's say not 20, go back 25 years. A working day in the life of Craig was a little different.
Oh, yeah. Just life in general, not just a working day, but life in general was quite different. Yeah, I was running around on motorcycles, having a lot of fun with my Hells Angels buddies, causing a bit of trouble, trying to do a bit of work, surfing, certainly living a far less disciplined lifestyle.
Clearly having a great deal of fun, and yet with this burning desire to add the missing piece of the puzzle. What was it about the allure of wine that said, this is something I have to do?
It's one of those situations where you don't consciously go into something, and you know, you're aware of it, you enjoy it, but somehow it finds you. So I didn't go and consciously seek this out. We sort of found each other.
You don't sort of just wake up one morning and, ooh, I'm a winemaker. So how did that process play out?
That's
really
why
don't
I'm
know
saying,
your story. It
was a long, drawn-out process. Fortunately, not a painful, drawn-out process, but a long process of transition. So we had a weekend farm long ago. I can't even remember how long ago, 20-something years ago. Loved it out in the country. And then we decided we wanted to move from Cape Town out into the country and raise our kids in the country. At that stage, they were 1 and 3 years old. And we decided to sell up in Cape Town, and we bought the farm that we're on now. So we sold the old farm, sold our house in Cape Town. We bought in the Himmel and Arder, which back then was quite a... it raised a few eyebrows amongst my peers. The Himmel and Arder back then was a gravel road. There were three other wineries. It was a bit of a muddy backwater, the boondocks. You know, there was Hamilton Russell and Bouchard Finlayson, the Newton Johnsons that just set up camp at Cape Bay. Their current winery didn't exist. Newton Johnson didn't exist per se.
No, I have this vision of you getting into a cart and being taken from Hermanus out into
a trip to Hermanus takes about 5 minutes, but back then on the gravel road with a sick oxen limping, it could take anything up to an hour or two.
And it was a big switch, not just from where you were living, but what you were doing, because you were it was the directing world, the advertising world.
Yeah.
Did that then just suddenly come to a halt?
No, I kept that going. You know, if you're not setting up a winery on trust funds or corporate money, you're doing it on your own. You need another stream of income. I kept working away. So I kind of had I had two lives, really. One city life, like you said, in production, directing commercials, and we had a studio that we did a lot of visual effects and high end 3D animation. So that was one life, and then the other life was farming and making wine, sort of in night times and on the weekends. So
how did that start? Because it's something I think many of us romantically think about. It would be lovely to have our own wine and make our wine, and that
does sound
garagist term.
Yeah,
and then you start and you realize it's horribly expensive, incredibly difficult, massively time consuming, and nowhere near as much fun as you thought it might be.
It was fun in the beginning because I had no pressure to make wine for the market. When we purchased the farm, there were a couple of hectares of vineyards on the farm. Nothing else, just bush. It was one of the situations where I was getting into wine. I'd actually planted a vineyard on the old farm before I sold it, the weekend farm. So I was already moving in that direction, certainly drinking a lot of wine. And once we purchased the farm that we're currently on now, Restless River, I had the grapes. So I thought, well, may as well try and make some wine. It can't be that difficult.
Although this is 20 years ago, so obviously you didn't have the internet then, so you couldn't just Google how to make wine.
Well, there was the internet. It was just a lot of buffering. And it was
you couldn't make
slow.
Phone calls at home if you were busy downloading your Super Mail.
It's much trickier. It was trickier back then than it would be now. But I did do a lot of research. Once I'm into something, I jump down that hole. And it's like anything that you're very into, especially something that is quite technical or can be. It's an endless sort of pit. Of information, and so I try and get in and source as much information as I can. But at the end of the day, there's only so much you can do with the information. You know, reading can't give you a sense of feel and smell and touch, and that's where I think the main light bulb moments were in terms of making wine, was being able to feel my way through it with, I guess, some type of an intuition.
You also decided to kick off, appropriately given it's the Gemellinada, Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, going straight into making Pinot Noir. It's kind of like bypassing your, not just your bachelor's, but your master's as well. Let's just start with our doctorate and go from there, because this is not the easiest grape to work with.
Well, no, I actually didn't start initially with Pinot Noir. When we purchased the farm, there were a couple of hectares of cab on that property. Now, that was... that's another whole story altogether. We probably don't have enough time for that. But the long and the short of that story is that the Gemellinada has become really well known for Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. And I've been this lone ranger, pioneer of Cab Sav in that area. I didn't pull it out. I decided to work with it to see what it could do there. And it did amazing things and did a lot for us as a brand. So I kept plugging away at it, and it was something that taught me a lot. And then after that, I planted Pinot and started making Pinot. So the Cab came first and Chardonnay, and I then started with the Pinot. But the Pinot's been a challenging journey, but I do feel that we've hit the target now, so getting a lot more settled about it.
Was there a point in this journey where you kind of accidentally fell into the world of wine as a commercial director, where you woke up one morning and you thought, you know what, I think we might actually have got there. I think we might now be still getting there.
No, I don't know. I even in my previous life, being in the creative industry, you know, you're never really satisfied with your end result, because you always see where you could have made it could have been better.
But at what point did you stop at dinner party saying, hi, I'm Craig, I'm a director, and start saying, hi, I'm Craig, I'm a winemaker?
Yeah, that's been an easy one, because I've never told anyone what I've done, regardless.
Hi, I'm Craig, I'm a surfer.
Yeah, or not even. Sometimes just hi. Most of the time, it's just hi. Or my wife Anne would be the one to say, oh, by the way, this is Craig. I'm actually quite introverted, believe it or not. Yeah.
You have got this brand now. The success of it is staggering. It is very hard to get hold of your wine. It's on allocation now, which means if you're not on the magic list getting bottles, it's quite difficult. Does that surprise you where you've got today, where the level of wine is, or was that self-belief always simmering?
I think it's a combination of things. I'm not surprised. We've worked really hard and we're in the perfect place to grow the type of wines that we're making. So those planets are all in alignment. So it's not surprising that we're making good wine. I think it would be surprising if we weren't, given the resources that are available to us in terms of where we're farming and the way we're making our wines. We should be making decent wines. What is surprising, though, is the uptake from the consumer and the industry. That's been very rewarding to be recognized for what you're doing, particularly when you're working so hard at it. So it's been quite a quick rise in the minds of a lot of people, but the reality is always very different.
It's been 20 years for overnight success.
It's been 20 years, yeah. And that's not even the cliche. This year is 20 years. So we've been plugging away at it relatively quietly, flying under the radar a lot of the time because that's our style. We're not into hype. We just get on and do our stuff, and it's what we do speak for itself. So it is a bit of a slower journey if you do it that way. But I think at the end of the day, it's a little bit more authentic.
Lots of hard work's gone into it, but not to the sacrifice of everything else.
Hell no.
Because most of the time when I try and get hold of you, I then end up having to get hold of your wife, and she says, "Now I'm afraid he's off surfing," which seems to happen most days. What is it about winemakers and surfing? It's almost as though you cannot make wine unless you like to go surfing.
I don't know. I get asked that question quite a bit. I think it's something in particularly the South African industry. Perhaps it's because most of our wine growing regions are coastal, as opposed to, say, Burgundy, which is continental. So we have access to the ocean. And I think being outdoors orientated, most winemakers are very into the outdoor side of things. It's not that attractive spending all day in a cold, damp cellar. We like being in the vineyards and being outdoors. And obviously surfing is a real sort of great outdoor activity. And it's just... It might also be a self-fulfilling prophecy as well. Once you're in the wine industry and your mates are all surfing, you go surfing. That's what you do. And it's so good. So it's hard not to.
You do a lot of surfing then. You make a lot of wine. You also do a lot of travel, and you've just got back from America.
Yeah.
I think it's harder work than people often imagine. It sounds pretty glamorous. That's good, traveling the world. Yeah. But it is something that wine's afforded you, this chance to see different corners of the planet, taking your wine to new markets and discovering new worlds.
It's an incredible gift, actually, the travel side. Most businesses don't afford you that type of travel. And if they do, not necessarily the type of travel that we do. So yes, it is taxing. I mean, you just mentioned that trip to the States. Now we traveled from the East Coast to the West Coast, back to the East Coast, I think in 12 days, a different city every day. And you're just at functions. There's no time for sightseeing or there's barely time to sleep. But you're traveling in such a way that you're with really good people. And you're talking about super interesting things. And then that trip is a bit of an exception. Quite regularly, though, on these trips, you do get the opportunity to get a bit of time off where you can then go and see things and do things that you otherwise wouldn't be able to. But the real beauty of it is the people that you meet along the way and your experiences along the way. Those are really special. And working with like-minded people.
Has it changed in the time you've been traveling, the kind of conversations you have? Do you still have to explain to people where South Africa is and introduce the fact that we are a wine-producing nation? Or is the rest of the world a little more au fait with the South African story?
I think the rest of the world's becoming more au fait. There's certain parts of the world. Look, we export to 14 countries. But there's certain, so I can see which parts of the world aren't that au fait and which are. And I think in... Overall, there's a lot more of an awareness about South Africa wine. But nevertheless, it's still a lot of hard work. You know, the States is a good example where a lot of people 10 years ago probably were not that familiar with, you know, you say you're from South Africa and then they'll ask you, oh, and what country are you from? So that is changing. The beauty of the world wine scene is that it does seem to be getting more progressive, and younger consumers are coming through, younger drinkers are coming through, and they're more curious, more adventurous. And it's just a matter of time until the real sort of old farts of the wine world are out, and we have a more dynamic wine drinker that is more open to exploring places afar.
We are exploring not just your story, but also some wine. I asked you to bring in one bottle today. This is not the wine that I first discovered you through. In fact, yeah. I remember somebody telling me we've had this brilliant Cabernet Sauvignon from the Gemellanada, and because there's nothing I don't know about wine, I put them in their place very quickly and said, no, they don't make Cabernet Sauvignon in the Gemellanada. You've clearly got that wrong. And subsequently discovered and then fell in love with the fact that Restless River,
yeah,
breaking many rules, happily makes Cabernet Sauvignon and very successfully. And that, I think, has become such an iconic wine for you, the Main Road and Dignity. What you do have is an equally celebrated one, and this is your Le Luc, which is special not just because Pinot Noir has become a marquee wine for you, but because it also celebrates a now, I think by my calculation, 6'11", 20-something year old with a slightly unfortunate moustache and clearly his parents' love of wine.
Yeah, you're obviously talking about Luc. He's actually joined the business now, so that's really nice. You know, on that note, just these last 20 years, as we've been talking, when you're planting vineyards and setting things up, it's a bit like planting a tree. You don't really do it for yourself. You know, you plant a tree for your grandchildren. They're the ones who are going to get the benefit from it. So we've always had in mind a next generation.
Well, thank you. You were thinking of me, and I appreciate
and,
that.
And, you know, as I see,
the young
you, I see you as my
space.
Very, very young brother, and one day, you know. So it's nice to have the next generation on board now. But back to the Pinot, this vineyard was planted in 2013. Luc was 13. Our Chardonnay, called Ava Marie, that's a beautiful old vineyard, about 26 years old now. And that was named after our daughter. Our wines, incidentally, are named after the vineyards. And those two vineyards happen to be named after our kids. I don't have a child called Main Road. Or Dignity, but not yet anyway.
We won't look at place of conception. Let's stick with the names of the kids.
So that vineyard was in the greater scheme of things, it's still quite young, but it is now producing really exceptional Pinot. The vineyard is more established. The farmer farming that vineyard and making the wine from it, obviously myself, is more established. The vineyard and I have built up a good relationship with each other. We have a better understanding of each other, and I feel that we're really able to hone in on the best parts of that vineyard and get that expressed in the bottle now. So the Pinot is really firing on all cylinders now.
Oh, it's about 7:10 in the morning, which is as good a time
late,
as
really?
Any.
My God.
To have the first
I thought I got
glass
you at 5.
Of wine. Cheers.
It's fantastic drinking Pinot. Well, I think it's 7:15 now.
7:15 in a £4.70 wine glass.
Just gargle with it. It's a great mouthwash.
In fact, I think this glass is actually heavier than the bottle. Oh.
Mm. Even at this time of the morning, it's showing itself.
I say this with only a certain level of facetiousness. The Pinot Noir as a breakfast wine has got a lot going for it because there is a lightness of touch to it. It's not a big, heavy thug of a wine.
Yeah.
It's got elegance. I could start my day with Pinot Noir very well. The day might go downhill quite rapidly, but I could certainly start it with Pinot Noir.
I think you could end it with Pinot Noir as well. It's an amazing thing, this Pinot. It's often referred to as the heartbreak grape. It's a tricky one to make. It's a tricky one to farm. And then on top of that, one of the other cliches about it is, you know, you get red wine, you get white wine, and then you get Pinot. it's sort of neither a red or a white wine. But once you get into it, and you really start to get into it, it's very difficult to it's very taxing on your sort of monthly budget. Once you get into Pinot, it's generally an expensive wine. And once you really get into Pinot, you have to start spending more and more and more money to feed this
rabbit hole that is Burgundy.
Exactly. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about Burgundy because I think there's been a perceptible shift over even the last 5 years, where certainly amongst people who drank wine, the thought was the Hemelanada is the Burgundy of South Africa. And it's well-intentioned and it's a nice idea.
Yeah.
But my feeling is that the real understanding, definitely from the wine producers and increasingly from those of us who drink it, is that, yes, that is a nice thing to say, but actually we're the Hemelanada on our own terms. We're not trying to make a red Burgundy. We're not trying to make a white Burgundy. The grapes might be the same, but this is very much South African wine.
100%. I mean, Burgundy makes Burgundy. We make Pinot Noir.
They are starting to call Burgundy the Hemelanada of France, which I think is very nice.
You know, it's long overdue. I mean, it's taken some time, but the French are slow to catch on, and also quite resistant. But
I'm just watching our numbers in bone plummet as they fall. No, off.
Look, I mean, the reality of it all is that Burgundy's become super expensive, and I think, I look at where we're selling Pinot around the world, the Hemelanada Pinot has developed a reputation quite quickly in the greater scheme of things. And wine is a long-term, slow process. So the rate at which the Hemelanada has started to develop a reputation for the Burgundian varietals has been quite remarkable. And I see it in some of our markets where the quality of our wines from the coming out of the Hemelanada really, really become an attractive alternative for people seeking really high quality Burgundian varietals, and their alternative being not having to purchase Burgundy all the time. You know, a lot of our wines are equal to and if not better than your average Burgundy Village, or even some of the Premier Crus. I don't think France will admit that, but I certainly believe that.
If you had a visa for France, it has now been revoked for the rest of your life.
It's okay. I've got connections.
And we have a World Cup trophy.
I wasn't going to go there, but yeah.
I don't think, just as with Cup Classique and Champagne, we have some fun with the conversation, but I don't think it's ever a contest in that sense. I think we're all making terrific wine, but it's lovely that both wines are brought into that same conversation, and that wouldn't have happened 20 years ago when you were still catching a ride on a horse to get out to Restless River along a dirt track through the vineyards, which leads me, before we let you head off and I finish the bottle of Pinot Noir in a dark corner quietly, to that vineyard. I've been lucky enough to come and spend some time with you.
Yeah.
And it's when, for me, the real farmer comes out and the winemaker gets put away, and you just see the delight as we got into your 200-year-old, I think it's a Jeep of sorts that appears to have been handmade out of spare parts.
Yeah, and that's a modern Land Rover, actually.
It's the newest one I've ever been on.
Yeah, brand new Defender.
The 1806 model is just out.
Yeah, 6-inch nails, wire, and duct tape.
We went through, and you were childlike. You're pointing out the vineyards, and this is when this one grew, and this is where we get the grapes from. And the city boy ad exec with the Beverly Hills blonde shock of hair and the model good looks turns out to actually be this really happy farmer in his spiritual home. And I think that's wonderful.
It is. Yeah. I mean, I think it's who I really am, to be honest. I like to be out in the country. I like to be outdoors. I love to be in my vineyards. It's a place of sanctuary for me, and it's a way to recharge the social battery that's often flat. So it's a great place to be in. It's incredible to be able to plant something and watch it grow and nurture it, and then actually make something out of it that is as beautiful as wine, and consume it and share it with people. It's quite something. There's not many. there are not many crops out there that you could do something similar with. And then also, obviously, the lifestyle on a wine farm may look pretty glamorous from the outside, but it's obviously a day-to-day grind with the usual challenges of business. But once all the staff leave the farm and it's 5 o'clock in the evening or a weekend, and you walk around, you're walking around your own little slice of paradise, and that's also quite rewarding and farming. So I absolutely love the farm, and I love the vineyards, and my happy place.
Like there is a romance to making grapes that you probably couldn't align with farming potatoes, for instance, or something similar.
Well, maybe if we were making vodka, yeah.
Perhaps that's the next Restless River adventure. Craig, thank you. I know that your time up in Joburg is precious for you before you can rush back to the farm and get surfing. Thank you for a wonderful breakfast in a glass. I hope you realize how much you and your wine means to me by the considerable investment in the glassware that we made just for today. I think I also forgot to mention the R9.99 corkscrew, which just added to the class and dignity of this morning. But thank you. You've given us a wonderful story. And although your departure 20 years ago almost collapsed the South African advertising and commercial directing industry, bore the wine industry a wonderful new chapter, and we are far richer for it. So thank you.
Dan, thanks very much. It's an absolute pleasure to be on your show. Thank you. Cheers.
Craig Vessels, Restless River, confirming what I've always said, the best breakfast in the world is Pinot Noir.